Continuing my intermittent sermon series on how ideas about the soul affect both individuals and society, I'll again start with a condensed review of what's come before, though since the series is getting longer, I can only touch on bits. So please remember that you can also access audio recordings of prior installments on the UUCPA website, if you like. So I've described how, while the modern era has given humankind immense gifts, its dominant philosophy of materialism, which holds that physical matter constitutes the whole of reality, has also purged any transcendent or transrational, that is, beyond the rational aspect from human life. And I've proposed that the resultant spiritual vacuum causes major personal and collective problems, and also, in agreement with mythologist Joseph Campbell, that archaic religious remedies, primarily meaning believe this or land in hell, Christianity and Islam, now mainly only aggravate these and related ills. Then, drawing on Plato, although there are other sources, I offered a very different transrational template from those of traditional religions. The main points are that human beings have a soul and enter the world with a life blueprint and a personal calling and destiny. Plato also describes the soul's spirit companion, termed daimon, D-A-I-M-O-N, in Greek, and genius in Latin, that guides the soul during its earthly excursion. And further, that when people identify and live out this calling as wholeheartedly as possible, it's personally beneficial and potentially culturally transformative. My latest installments then broadly described the historical emergence of materialism's modern soulless worldview, including the very understandable reasons this first became normalized, which was largely to break free of religious superstition and tyranny. I sum this up by observing that the same modern era cultural voyage that produced such enormous benefits has also wreaked unequaled devastation, including on indigenous peoples by Western colonialist and religious powers under the Catholic Church's doctrine of discovery, which sanctioned the European, at the time mainly Spanish, seizure of the Americas. A voyage contemporary French cultural critic and philosopher Paul Virilio pithily captured by remarking that when you invent the ship, you also invent the shipwreck. Then last week, I focused on why some people have such a hard time admitting that modernism has any shipwreck side at all. A ruinous parallel to the doctrine of discovery I call the doctrine of denial. I contrasted this with how postmodernism's general willingness to consider multiple perspectives tends to foster better understanding of others' realities and thus is often a starting point for empathy, which can then seek improvements. As explained before, while there's no one definition of postmodernism, I'm using thinker and author Stephen McIntosh's characterization of a more attentive and inclusive worldview that is, quote, comprised of the victims of modernity, including individual people, races, and cultures, and the overall natural environment, together with those who are sensitive to the pain of victimization, even though they may not have been directly victimized themselves. And I shared how, from the mid-20th century until today, this cultural split has fueled a war of the world views between those striving to foster a more equitable and sustainable planetary community based on universal regard for others and the Earth, and those determined, consciously or unconsciously, to retain their psychological equilibrium and or their parochial power and privilege by zealously denying modernism's lengthening shadow. But personally or collectively, in dealing with altered circumstances and new understandings, denial is not a functional, much less healthy, strategy. Thus, I ended last week by saying that what renowned psychologist Carl Jung observed about individual life stories is also true of civilizational narratives and the historical eras based on them. He writes, "One cannot live in the afternoon of life according to the program of life's morning, for what was great in the morning will be of little importance in the evening, and what in the morning was true will at evening become a lie." We continue now by looking at more cultural effects of disimaginative doctrine of denial fabrications. And because, as someone once said, no one ever loves you for stripping them of their illusions, we begin with why the foremost attendant emotion of denialists is incensed indignation. The dramatic climax of a well-known fable illustrates. Many of you will recall that in the original The Wizard of Oz film, young heroine Dorothy and her Land of Oz friends, the Scarecrow, Tin Man, and Cowardly Lion, fretfully enter the wizard's inner sanctum. Amidst the fire and smoke spewing around this gigantic, ethereal visage, they inform him they've accomplished their part of the earlier bargain and now want him to fulfill his part by helping Dorothy return home to Kansas. Astonished that they've actually brought him the dead Wicked Witch of the West's broomstick, that is, realizing their claim is legitimate, the wizard says he needs more time to think about it and to come back tomorrow. Along with other denialist tactics I identified last week, for instance, categorically dismissing any and all criticism, heaping scorn and ridicule on anyone who questions their accepted order, and sanctimoniously blaming those modernism has victimized, vague intimations that things will get better tomorrow is yet another tactic. When they dare to challenge him to keep his bargain now, his earth-shaking voice tries to intimidate them. Do not arouse the wrath of the great and powerful Oz. But Dorothy has waited long enough and exclaims, if you were really great and powerful, you'd keep your promises. And here his mounting ire reveals his and denialism's underlying presumption of unassailable omnipotence. Do you presume to criticize the great Oz, you ungrateful creatures? At this moment, Dorothy's little dog Toto detects some activity to one side. He trots over and pulls back a curtain concealing a mechanical control console, revealing a man frantically twirling knobs and pulling levers while yelling into a microphone, now most famously and futilely, pay no attention to that man behind the curtain. But he's been exposed for who he really is. The all-powerful brow-beating persona is a protective facade. The Scarecrow bellows, you humbug! That is, fraud, liar. And to his everlasting credit, the shame-faced sham wizard owns up. Yes, that's exactly so. I'm a humbug. Sadly, outside of Oz, the psychosocial dynamics that underpin the doctrine of denial make such admissions rare. Instead, the usual reaction is some mix of the tactics just named, which in Toto entails yanking the curtain closed while trying to kick the spit out of Toto. This is evident in a thousand ways. Yet a few textbook example words uttered in the 1960s as postmodernism fully began to reveal modernism's deficiencies speaks volumes about the general dynamic. For after the enslavement of African Americans, followed by another 100 years of bigotry, bullying, and lynchings, and now in the midst of the sometimes deadly white supremacist attacks in 1960s civil rights leaders and supporters I spoke of previously, the doctrine of denial permitted a white man from the American South to say, our colored people will do exactly as they have done. Our white people will do exactly as they have done. Why? Because it's worked out best. For denial's defenders, this axiom has endless applications. From domineering, if not outright abusive, men to women, because it's worked out best. From heterosexual homophobes to non-heterosexuals, because it's worked out best. From a relative handful of billionaires to billions of poor people, because it's worked out best. From polluting profiteers to Earth's people, other creatures, and the life-sustaining systems on which existence itself depends, because it's worked out best. Ad infinitum and nauseam. But continuing here with the example of racial prejudice, another white Southerner's words shows that people can and do transcend the provincial programming of their life's mourning. I grew up in the South, a child of good and decent parents. We had black women who worked in our household, sometimes surrogate mothers. I can't believe I couldn't see them. I don't know where my head or heart was. I don't know where my parents' heads or hearts were, or my teachers. I never heard it once from the pulpit. We were blind to the reality of racism and afraid, I guess, of change. Like many of their neighbors, those parents of esteemed journalist John Siegenthaler were good and decent within their highly restricted range of vision. But responding to a question from Bob Dylan's Blowin' in the Wind that many were hearing at the time, how many times can a man turn his head and pretend that he just doesn't see? Siegenthaler's blinders fell, and he found the missing pieces of his younger head and heart. Applying these in 1961 as a special assistant to U.S. Attorney General Robert Kennedy, he found himself mediating between the federal government, the racial mix of mostly young people riding buses into the Deep South to protest illegal segregation practices, and white political and law enforcement officials who often allowed and sometimes directly abetted the organized terrorism that met these freedom riders. After a white mob in Alabama tried to murder one busload of riders with a firebomb, on May 20th, he was present when a second mob met another unprotected bus at Montgomery's Greyhound Station. As it began to attack some 20 freedom riders, black and white, female and male, Siegenthaler saw a skinny youth punching a woman's face bloody and tried to get her into his car. And at that moment, he said, they wheeled me around and they hit me with a pipe. The blow behind his left ear floored him in near unconsciousness, though he does recall that they kicked me under the car and left me there. So for being among those pulling back the painstakingly spun curtain on this aspect of the doctrine of denial, another head among those who would no longer turn away was bloodied by its inherent violence. The fact that in his youth, Siegenthaler never even heard racial injustice discussed attests to how tightly woven such closed curtains and closed ranks can be. This is why all sorts of privileged, because it's worked out best groups, can so readily mistake being awakened to a wider field of vision with being victimized, an error rife among denialists today, but that wise souls like Ralph Waldo Emerson judiciously strive to avoid. Let me never fall into the vulgar mistake, Emerson wrote, of dreaming that I am persecuted whenever I am contradicted. Again, all this exists on a spectrum. So using the terms broadly, this isn't to say that all modernists are more defensive and all postmodernists more altruistic regarding every ethical issue. But while allowing for overlap and variations in these designations, the overall propensity is nonetheless clear. And there's a worldview of difference between letting initial internal psychological dissonance congeal into self-serving dogma, as with the because it's worked out best man and his ilk, and realizing that one's limited outlook needs expanding, as John Siegenthaler did. Also, on one level, this isn't a new dynamic. In every era, there have been more and less open-minded and open-hearted people, and those who stood up and sometimes sacrificed for those unlike themselves. Instances include men who supported women's suffrage and white abolitionists who fought slavery and others extending back to antiquity. But as described in some detail last week, including how first-time photos of the Earth from space awoke many people to life's ultimate unity. Never before has considering the entire world been necessary. Never before could anyone validly declare, as world religion scholar Houston Smith does now, that we have come to the point in history when anyone who is only Japanese or American, only Oriental or Occidental, is only half human. The other half that beats with the pulse of all humanity has yet to be born. So too, the heart that beats with the pulse of our living starship Earth, now seen as never before. A bumper sticker I once saw puts this postmodern truth even more concisely. One people, one planet, one future. And philosopher Immanuel Kant ties an ethical outcome to this new awareness and ability now required. For peace to reign on Earth, humans must evolve into new beings who have learned to see the whole first. The postmodern worldview has indeed helped many see more of the whole and to some extent evolve accordingly. Yet for all its vision and heart and perspective expanding positives, to various degrees it has its own troubling shadow and its own disimaginative blinders, including to the reality of the human soul. Next week, I'll wrap up this section of our series for the summer with a look at these and why this worldview cannot form the transrational foundation for a profoundly evolutionary, soul-focused life. Namaste and blessed be.